session number 4844, reel 5.
Mr. Prosser, British Naval Cameraman, reel 5.
This meant, of course, that with the mast in the normal condition, the captain could have dived quite safely and kept my feet dry, possibly a foot or so above the water. But with the centre section gone, it meant that I had to induce him, and he was rather loath to do this because of danger in his view, it didn't bother me. It meant that he had to dive, really, so that the water level was up to my waist, or almost up to the camera, which was just above my waist. The bottom of the camera was just above my waist, resting on my chest. Having finally achieved this, achieved agreement on this, we went ahead and dived, starting with the shot of the submarine cruising on the surface and then going into the full dive operation and blowing tanks and diving very smartly, so that eventually we finished up with empty water, shot almost from water level with the tops of the waves coming dangerously close to the bottom of the camera. But because the captain was so worried about my safety, which hadn't really bothered me at this point, I had phenomenal confidence in him, he put up the periscope rather too early. I had expected a sort of 10-second shot of empty water, but he was so worried by this that he put the periscope up almost immediately. He'd leveled off and the jumping wires were just out of shot. And instead of putting it up as I'd asked him to originally, so it was facing forward, he put it up to look at me, and I could see the two prisms winking at me like two fingers as he was looking up and down to see whether I got my head underwater or not. And we were both so confused by this, although we both knew perfectly well that you could not communicate orally through the periscopes at all. He was actually shouting at me, saying, "My God, Prosser, are you all right?" I discovered later. And I was shouting back to him, "For God's sake, man, put down that bloody periscope and then bring it up again 5 seconds later." And I made suitable gestures accordingly, and eventually it worked out all right, but it meant that I was more nearly running out of film at the end of the sequence on that magazine. And I didn't have a spare magazine with me because it might have got wet. Anyway, this went ahead. The sequence was completed, the periscope looking round the whole horizon, because the normal search procedure is when you up periscope, you put it up only an inch or two above the surface and have a quick look round through 360 degrees to make sure there isn't anything hostile on the horizon. Anyway, this was done, and I made the signal to surface again, and we went through the reverse part of the operation. And the whole thing, in the end, went surprisingly well. What is interesting about it, though, is that that sequence was sufficiently good to be used in, I think, 3 subsequent feature films, and I was able to identify my very own shots because of this broken mast. Before we dived and after we'd surfaced, as we rolled in the waves slightly on the surface, there was a bump at the end of each roll with a loose section of broken telescopic mast, with the result that I could identify my own shots absolutely clearly. And there was no question about it, this was used in the feature films, together with the whole of my attack sequence down in the control room.
Can you remember any of the feature films?
I can't remember the names of them. It certainly wasn't We Dive at Dawn, but there were, I think, 2 British and 1 American films made towards the middle of the war, within a few years, who did in fact use this sequence.
Presumably you had to stunt any attack sequences and sinking.
Yes, the next problem, I beg your pardon, the next problem was to show another sequence of firing torpedoes at an enemy ship and seeing her blow up when the torpedoes hit her. The first thing was, I wanted, again because it hadn't been used or shown before, a close shot with a submerged submarine, just shallow enough to be able to see the torpedo tube tracks leave the bows as they were fired, which meant shooting from the surface. In those days we had no underwater cameras, there was no such facility available anywhere. And also, a shot from the submarine, simulated as though seen through the periscope, of the enemy ship blowing up when the torpedoes struck. And this meant that we had to get the submarine into such a position, with a motorboat lying off ahead of her, submerged, and very slowly underway, filming from the motorboat and firing torpedoes. This sequence was, I think, in fact, shot by John Turner, and I know he told me subsequently that, unfortunately, one of the torpedoes ran rather too shallow and made a severe hole in the motorboat, which was the property of the captain of the submarine flotilla in the depot ship, and he'd only lent us this boat with, and given us these enormous facilities, so it was extremely embarrassing to have to go back after being rescued from this and to say to him, sorry, sir, we've sunk your motorboat. However, that was achieved all right in the end. Turner managed to save the film all right. Then we had to find a ship which we could sink. Well, obviously this wasn't very practical, and you couldn't go to sea and actually do it on genuine enemy because you couldn't be sure of meeting up with one at the right time and place. I eventually discovered a ship that had been sunk by some sort of action or other and was lying in very shallow water, and she looked at a distance as though she was still afloat. And as she was virtually a hulk, she still had most of her superstructure, funnels, masts, and so on, and therefore it was quite viable to put a torpedo into her and blow her up. In fact, we put two in, I think. And so one filmed this. I forget whether we did it from the casing of the submarine or what, but at any rate, we fired torpedoes and we viewed it from the submarine's angle and duly got the explosions and everything else and the torpedo tracks and so on. So that sequence worked very well. And to cut a long story short, the submarine film was completed effectively, I think, shooting terms about 6 or 7 weeks with intervals for an odd Malta convoy or something in between. And when we got all the negative back, which I think we then had processed in Cairo for this purpose, I had a print made, and I took the print down to Studio Missa, where I rented a cutting room. And I'd never cut film before in my life, but I knew the principles, and furthermore, I knew exactly how the film was going to appear. Turner was unable to cooperate appreciably on this, so I just went down there with the script and started learning how to cut and join film. And I sent back to Movie Turn in London eventually a cutting copy, complete with written commentary, recommended music and sound effects and so on, that they would have to put on in London. And after a suitable interval of time, I in fact got cables and letters of congratulation from Movie Turn saying, jolly good show after all, okay, we were wrong, well done, and it's selling in 20 languages.
What did the Navy think of it?
The Navy were tickled pink because it was the first time they'd really had a good story, and news came back from London that it was extremely well received there. News duly got back to Alexandra, and the fleet heard about it, and I'm not sure, I believe a copy was sent out, or a couple of copies were sent out to Cairo so that it could be seen in cinemas in Cairo and Alexandra, and I think quite a number of officers involved were very pleased with it. Inevitably there were the slight criticisms where I'd had to stunt certain things, obviously, and the reply to that simply was, well, how else do you suggest we do it? But this was regarded as perfectly valid. And the film was ultimately so successful that the Dutch Navy later approached me when I got back to UK and asked me to write a similar script for them, using one of their submarines, but in home waters.
Did it produce a more positive attitude from the Navy towards publicity? Did they suggest any further projects to you?
They didn't actually suggest any. I suggested a few to them, and they were very keen to adopt them. One was a Fleet Air Arm film based on the few remaining biplane aircraft that we had based at Decatur, just outside Alexandria, to the west. That didn't materialise for a number of reasons, mainly operational at the time. But it didn't really change the attitude, because the attitude of the Navy by this time was so cooperative from my point of view, particularly the seagoing personnel, that I had nothing whatever to complain about. I mean, one could sum it up by saying, after all, it's not everywhere, even today, that a young man of 25 or so could go to the Navy and say, in the middle of a war, I want the full facilities of one submarine, one ship's company of the submarine, and a naval liaison officer to help me out with technicalities, to go ahead and make this film. And what's more, I want it for about 6 weeks. This, to me, was such a complete volte-face from the early days that one couldn't ask for anything better.
You mentioned earlier that you occasionally worked with the Army during quiet moments in naval operations. Did you cover any notable Army operations?
Not technically notable. the one basic one, which really one got no real pictures of at all in valuable terms, was the join up of the 8th Army with the in-sieged unit at Tobruk. But in fact, prior to that, I did go up to Tobruk soon after a Malta convoy, so it would be a fairly long lull, and joined the 4th Indian Division to cover their advance and capture of Derna.
You went to Tobruk how?
I went to Tobruk in one of the fast mine layers. I forget whether it was Abdil, Latona, or Manxman. I think Abdil had been sunk, so it was probably Latona at that time. They were one of the standard means of getting to Tobruk rather fast overnight because they could cruise at 40 knots, which was very unusual in those days. There I met up with the Indian Army, and whether or not I'd gained the intelligence that they were going to invest Derna before or after I got to Tobruk, I don't know. But at any rate, I managed to hitchhike a lift with an Indian Army officer who was also a film cameraman in his lorry. And I joined a convoy which was going to advance on Derna. And with my usual abruptness, when the convoy pulled off the road for the night to park, I was horrified to find that the officer in charge of it, who hadn't had much operational experience, had parked the whole lot nose to tail. And as there were something like 30-odd vehicles, this was extremely hazardous for the usual dawn dive bomb attack. And with my usual cheek as a civilian, I promptly got out and told the army how to do it and said, look here, you've really got to go and separate all these vehicles and give them at least 100 yards apart and don't leave them in a straight line. Otherwise, you'll lose the whole darn lot at dawn and you'll lose all your personnel as well. He seemed rather surprised by this, that a fellow dressed as I was, after all, in a beard and a naval cap and tropical riding breeches, it did look a bit odd, should come and tell him how to run his own unit. However, he saw the point when I explained about the dive bombers, because if they'd been left in a line, you would only need about 4 dive bombers and they could destroy the entire force. As it was, we spread them out at 100-yard intervals, approximately in a square, which was a conventional way of doing things at that time, I think. And when the dive bomb attack came at dawn, I think we did lose 2 vehicles, and I think we only had 2 men injured. The whole of the rest was saved, and the injured men were shipped back to Tobruk for hospitalization. And we proceeded on the road up past Ghazala to Derna, only to find that the enemy had more or less evacuated the place, and we were able more or less to walk into the place, apart from a few escaping Italians from whom I captured a car, as I had no transport and was hitchhiking at the time. And I filmed all the rather unusual story of the Indian troops in Derna, bearing in mind they'd been in the desert for about 6 weeks, and therefore they hadn't seen very much in the way of water. And this particular group came from Kashmir, and they had this religious habit of wearing rolled-up beards. They never cut their hair or their beards. With the result, Derna being both on the coast and an oasis as well, there were lots of pools and fountains about the town, and one was treated to the unusual sight of all these chaps letting their hair down, literally. And when you were used to a man who normally had a beard that apparently shaped his chin and followed the moulding of his face, you suddenly found the chaps standing in shorts in the marketplace with beards down to their waists and hair down to their waists, all having a jolly good wash. And also, of course, they were able to have some decent food for a change because they'd been existing for all those weeks on iron rations. And so we had a very good dinner together that night, and they nearly killed me with their curry, which was so good, as they would allow me no water with it.
But you obtain nothing very much in the way of action footage?
Not particularly, no. There were the odd air attacks, again, on this sort of thing. And as far as I remember, they were rather amateurish. The Germans didn't seem to have an awful lot of fight in them at this particular moment, because it was mostly done by Italians, as far as I recall. And all I did really was film the unusual part of the Indian 4th Indian Division performance. And one has to bear in mind, of course, that except the English officers, none of them spoke my language. And one of the amusing effects of this was that while I was cruising around the suburbs of Derna doing filming of the actions of these Indian chaps, I was continually being arrested by them because the Indian troops had the idea that nobody in the British Army except they themselves were permitted to wear beards. And I was therefore regarded as hostile and probably enemy, and therefore continually was arrested, having got this car. I was driving around in it myself, and it meant that I was continually being taken back under escort, driving myself, with one of the Indian troops sitting with his rifle between his knees beside me, completely incapable of any sort of communication. And I would then drive back to the town major's office and say, look, old boy, we've got this problem again. Could you explain to these chaps, you know, that I'm not really the enemy? However, they were very reasonable about it. They didn't try to shoot me first, which the Poles would have done. And we got on very well. In the end, I had to get back for Malta convoy.
So you drove across the desert in your commandeered car?
Yes, this was really the only way I could get back. I couldn't get a ship from Derna, because it took a rather long time to get the harbour cleared, because most of it had been destroyed by the enemy before they left. I found I couldn't get a ship from Tobruk, and I'd never navigated the desert before in my life. And I hadn't done very much navigation, apart from rather cursory learning naval navigation. And I didn't have a sun compass, which was the customary aid in the desert in those days for vehicular transport. But I figured that I could do it. The reason I had to drive through the desert, perhaps one should say, was that from about 100 miles east of Tobruk to within 150 miles of Alexandria, the coast was held entirely by the enemy. This meant that one had to strike down at least 50 miles into the desert and then steer east, because the enemy were rather frightened of the desert and they didn't like going very deep into it. And normally, if you went about 50 miles south of the coast, you would expect to be reasonably clear of most of the enemy, apart from the odd tank patrol or something. And so I decided I would do this. My peculiar rig helped me to some extent and produced other problems as well. Because when I struck off the desert road to the south, I had to get some repairs done to this car because it was in a very, very bad shape indeed, especially across the desert. And one should mention that whereas one had a spare wheel, there were no tools whatsoever on the car. They were like gold dust in the desert. You couldn't beg, borrow, or steal them. They were needed far too much for operational vehicles. So I struck south for 50 miles and caught up with a South African camp near the border between the then border between Libya and Egypt. And this was shortly before Christmas 1941. And I arrived, not knowing what day it was by this time, but I arrived into this camp wearing a beard. And at that point, the South Africans were inclined to be very suspicious of people in beards, because in South Africa at the time there was a political party which was pro-Nazi called the Ottawa Brandtwag. And when I walked into this tent, all the men were carousing on Christmas Eve, all the officers were carousing on Christmas Eve, and as soon as I pulled the bell tent flap aside, they said, "Ah, Ottawa Brandtwag!" And I had to explain to them that I was nothing of the sort, you see. I didn't really know much about it, but I had met Peer off and one or two politicians from it in Britain earlier on, so I knew a little bit of it. However, I cleared myself, and they made me very welcome, repaired my vehicle as far as they could, and kept me there over Christmas Day. And strangely enough, presents even came in from various people in the desert that I'd never heard of before, one of them being a compass, which was extremely useful, which I didn't possess. It shows the sort of foolhardy thing one used to do in those days. I mean, to set off and hope to steer east by sun without the compass and without a sun compass or without a magnetic compass either was pretty chancy. I believed I could do it, and it was quite an experience. Anyway, they let me go after a sandstorm, which lasted right through Boxing Day and the day after. And finally they said I could go. And they said, of course, "Man, we think you're a fool to do it, you know." I mean, this was only a Fiat 1100, which is comparable with a Fiat 126 or something today, 127 today. And I took off with five jerry cans of water and about three of petrol, hoping for the best. And apart from stopping for one night alongside a sand dune, on the south side of a sand dune, and being just preparing to brew up some tea, I suddenly heard German voices on the other side of the sand dune. This rather put me off, because I assumed they were probably only they were enemy troops in tanks. And it meant that for the entire night I had to keep extremely quiet in case they heard me. And I was wondering how I was going to start the car in the morning without them hearing me. So I just had to wait until I heard the tank engine start up and then try and start my car undercover and head off to the southeast as smartly as possible. Fortunately, I succeeded in doing this. But apart from getting through minefields when you ran out of markers, because they used to mark minefields within our own lines normally, and occasionally these would blow down in a sandstorm or something, and if you ran out of the actual marker line, this was a bit dicey. But I succeeded in getting through this, and eventually, after losing an ignition coil, which broke down on me just as I hit the road, 140 miles from Alexandra, I happened to have picked up an ignition coil, a spare off a German vehicle at the time, which I managed to get off without tools. I managed to get back into Alexandra just in time for dinner after quite a long absence, and this meant that I was able to take off the following morning on the Malta convoy, which I'd intended to cover.
So you, in fact, made it back in time?
Just.
You retained the Fiat, I believe, for your own personal transport?
Yes, on the return to the Malta convoy, I took the whole problem to the naval authorities and said, look here, this has been issued to me officially by the Indian Army. I would like to register as an RN vehicle so that I can use it to get to and fro into port before an operation from my hotel. I've explained earlier why one lived in a hotel, not in a ship. This was done without ado, again through my good contacts in other senior officers and the actual press liaison people, and this meant I could draw naval petrol officially. I couldn't have naval workshop servicing, so I got it finally repaired in part, because it had been rather badly shot up with 0.5-inch machine guns, and the engine was in a very sorry state as well. The only thing I couldn't get for it was another battery, and this was in a pretty shaky sort of state, so it had to be parked on a hill outside the hotel, and in the morning to get it started, until I managed to solve the battery problem, I was known as Bush Captain, which meant that all the Boabs from the hotel and so on around, they used to come out and push me in the morning. The Egyptians were not normally able to pronounce the letter P.
The Navy had never made any efforts to provide you with any other transport?
No, none whatever, despite the fact that it meant that when we were going on an operation, we had to take an ordinary Egyptian taxi, which was a severe break on security in a way, in order to get into the port and get alongside the ship that you wanted to join. So using an RN vehicle was no problem. I could just leave it on the dockside, and this was a perfectly valid way of carrying on.
Were you allowed to retain the vehicle?
For many months, yes, I did retain the vehicle and used it entirely officially in the course of the job. Obviously, one went occasionally out to dinner in it and this sort of thing, but this was merely because one was probably dining naval officers or whatever. And, in fact, I used to drive Brigadier Williamson around quite a lot at night, who was a rather famous chap who led the tanks out of Tobruk when they were joining up with the 8th Army later on. He was a friend of mine. But, no, in the end, they did take it away from me when I rather got myself into disgrace one way or another through trying, battling to do my job rather too well and picking up a story ahead of Naval Intelligence.
This was the Perla incident?
Yes, that's right.
It was taken away from you then as a punitive measure?
Yes, following the Perla incident, I won't guarantee it was a punitive measure, but it was an odd coincidence. I was suddenly handed an order one day to say that the vehicle had to be returned to naval stores. So I said, all right, what about joining other ships and this sort of thing? They said, well, that's your problem. They required the transport. I was left in a jam for some considerable time over this, and I took various steps officially through normal channels initially to try and get myself issued with another naval vehicle. Well, they were obviously in short supply, but with the aid of the vehicle and driver of a friend of mine who was the fleet medical officer, I was able to go down to Tel el-Kebir, where I knew there was a dump of service vehicles awaiting issue. And I'd been told that officially there were no vehicles available whatsoever. I found about 200 of them on this dump, all lying idle, unissued. And I then asked to go and see the captain of the fleet who was responsible for this sort of thing, as being the top-level chap at the time. He refused to see me, which rather surprised me, because he was the first senior officer who'd ever refused to see me in the whole of my naval operations. And I was accustomed to drift into the Captain of Naval Intelligence's office and be seen within a few minutes if he wasn't actually in conference. So this treatment struck me as rather casual. So I wrote him a letter, and in my very brash fashion, of course, I did rather insult the fellow, because I implied that he hadn't really been telling the truth when he said there were no vehicles. As I pointed out, there were 200 lying idle in the desert, any one of which could have been issued to me and would have been quite adequate to avoid breaking security when joining ships. This resulted in this particular captain, the captain of the fleet, whose name escapes me, fortunately, putting the special investigation branch on to me, and they followed me for a bit. And shortly after this, the entire naval staff and the correspondents and the Wrens and Wren officers and everybody were evacuated from Alexandra to port side very suddenly overnight because the enemy had advanced to within 50 miles distant of Alexandra. And therefore, I was living in a hotel suddenly in port side, which was a disastrous hotel and full of fleas and heaven knows what. And I was moving out after a few days to a slightly better hotel, having finally managed to get myself a room with the rest of the naval staff. And I made a casual remark to a commander's wife who was sitting on the terrace having coffee. And the SIB bounced on this, didn't wait to hear the remains of the casual remark, which was a joke.
What was the casual remark?
I'm getting out. They are coming in at Damietta. And Sally Mell, the naval officer's wife, said, "What do you mean, David?" And I said, "Oh, well, it's only a gag. I'm moving to the Casino Palace Hotel." And she said, "Oh, well, good luck to you," sort of thing. And I was moving, I remind you, with best part of half a ton of equipment. Anyway, the SIB apparently really put this into operation, and I was promptly suspended for spreading alarm and despondency. This was the official charge. With the result that in the Casino Palace at night, it was quite amusing because half the naval staff used to drink with me round a very large semicircular bar, and the other half ignored me and cut me stone dead every morning, when one would normally say good morning to each other.
Even those that had been your acquaintances?
Oh, yes, those whom I knew quite well. They all pretended I didn't exist. The other half, who were on my side, sort of said, "Damn silly show, what absolute nonsense, have a drink, old boy." And this went on for some weeks. Meanwhile, it was being investigated by Admiral Harwood, who'd taken over from Admiral Sir Andrew Cunningham as Commander-in-Chief Eastern Mediterranean. And eventually, after due investigation, he cleared me and, to the best of my knowledge, sent the captain of the fleet home. So I was back in operations. But I did, as a result, miss one very important convoy, Malta convoy, in August. But I continued to operate perfectly normally after that, after clearance by Harwood.
But you did no naval work during the suspension?
During suspension, no. I did do quite a lot of other work, actually, because nobody else minded, and, you know, they all regarded the whole thing as being a bit stupid, and it was a form of venomous retaliation, I suppose, by one officer, really.
Did you find that when your suspension was cleared by Admiral Harwood's office that relations with all the naval officers returned to their normal amicable state?
Oh, yes, it was very amusing, in fact, because Harwood called me up one day and said, "You know, I can see you're a very, very enthusiastic young man in your work. You really shouldn't go attacking captains of the fleet quite in that sort of fashion, even if you have got your facts right. You are now henceforth cleared and available for operations as normal." I think we then had a drink and I went back to the Casino Palace, whereupon word had got back almost ahead of me to the naval staff there, whereupon people who'd refused to speak to me for weeks suddenly said, "Hello, old boy, where have you been?" and offered me a drink, as though, you know, they hadn't seen me for all that period, which was really quite amusing.
Did you manage to continue any form of naval work during your suspension?
Yes, in one sense. I wasn't able to do any actual naval filming, per se, certainly not at sea. I was banned from going to sea by the official naval authorities, and while I doubtless could have got myself into a ship with whose captain I was friendly, I wouldn't want to prejudice his position, so I didn't attempt to do this. However, I did keep my ear to the ground, and I was able to maintain full communications with my normal intelligence contacts and be informed as to what was going on. So it wasn't really that I wasn't trusted, except by one or two people that I regarded as mere bureaucrats. So I knew what was going on, but I was prevented from going on the most important August convoy. But possibly this was luck in a sense, because ship in which I would have gone to sea was very severely damaged and I might well have been killed. But nevertheless, I prepared myself for various other naval work, in particular an MTB story, which I was thinking of making into a film. And I did go north and do a good deal of preliminary filming in and off Beirut with MTBs for this particular purpose. And then I was recalled by my office to UK and went back. Well, I think the recall came somewhere around the end of September, and I actually finally got back to UK just before Christmas 1942, after which I went into other work.
Do you think there was any particular reason for your recall?
It may have had something to do with the fact that I'd been so darn stroppy and awkward all my naval life in trying to do the best for the job, but I don't think it reflected on me, because I was asked to do work with two other navies in the meanwhile, and subsequently, about May 43, I think, or earlier than May 43, I was in fact attached as an air correspondent to the Royal Air Force for operating over Europe, but this was prevented by my actually joining the Royal Air Force at this time.